University Detroit Tower chimes ring in another session of Ask the Professor, the radio program on which you match wits with University of Detroit professors in an unrehearsed session of questions and answers. Questions today about Melville, Charles Dickens, Tolstoy, and the Cambrian rocks. How's that? Today's panel, I'm the man with all of the questions and most of the answers, Bill Raby. On my right, history professor Frederick H. Hayes.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Professor Hayes. On my left, Russell McLaughlin of the University of Detroit Green Room Programs.
How do you do, I'm sure.
Yes. Thank you, Professor McLaughlin. And our middleman again, Professor John Mahoney of the University of Detroit English Faculty.
With approval of that, certainly. How do you do?
All of the questions used on this program are submitted by listeners. If you stump the experts, you will receive a subscription to a national magazine, The Atlantic, Harper's, or America. Now, this message from the University of Detroit.
This question for James T. Mansfield, Director of Admissions at the University of Detroit. Is credit awarded for grade 13 on Canadian high school transcripts?
While they are evaluating the entire system, presently it is given somewhat of transfer credit into American institutions. In other words, they may get some credit into the freshman year by taking a grade 13. The problem that arises is that when they do go back to Canada with their degree, if they haven't taken grade 13 there, they must, in effect, take a fifth year of college or an honors course type program.
Thank you. This question is from Carl Budd, B-U-D-D, of Detroit, Michigan, Granville Avenue, zip code 48228. It's about a 16-part question. Actually, he sent three questions, and again, we warn the listener, if you're going to send three, send them all in one batch.
You can't divide 16 by three.
No, but you can divide the sheets on which he writes them into three.
Yeah, but each one was sent in a separate envelope, you see.
Yeah, so he's wasting 12 cents there.
Yeah. I see what you mean, Fred, yeah. I bow to that brilliant piece.
Send them all in one envelope.
Brilliant piece of economic mathematics.
In Oscar Wilde's portrait of Dorian Gray, who was the artist who created the portrait?
Mr. Wilde himself, actually.
No, no, the name of the...
The name of the fictitious painter.
The fictitious painter.
Which I forget entirely.
I do, too. It wasn't Dorian Gray.
I never attended to it.
Basil Hallward. In Charles Dickens' Pickwick Papers, what was the name of the law firm which represented the plaintiff, Mrs. Bardell?
Oh, that was, wait a minute, give me a little tiny clue, will you?
Well, you may have a little trouble seeing the whole thing clearly. It may be sort of misted over.
Dim and dimmer.
Wait a minute, will you give me the first name of the firm?
Dodson.
These questions.
Dodson and Fogg.
All right.
Dodson and Fogg.
All right, half credit for that one. In Melville's Moby Dick, there was only one survivor from the ship. What ship rescued him?
The Rachel.
Right. Why on earth would you remember that?
Boy, are those are really precise little things.
Yeah, they very certainly are.
From the same novel, what was the name of the inn in which Ishmael and Queequeg shared a night's lodging while in New Bedford?
I have not read that for 1 year. And
I haven't read it longer than that, John. I can't remember those details.
It's related to a whale.
Yes, it is, and I forget entirely what it is. You know, the Harpoon's Barb or something like that.
Spouter Inn.
The Spouter Inn, right.
Who was the man who first deciphered cuneiform writing?
Well, Champollion, I suppose.
I have another name.
Who have you got?
I have George Friedrich Grotefend, which sounds sort of cuneiform.
Well, how about the Champollion's work with the Rosetta Stone? I think that's the first breakthrough on cuneiform. No, that wasn't cuneiform. No, that's hieroglyphics.
There are three, and wasn't one of them cuneiform?
Yeah.
There are three, the brilliant genius decided that they probably all said the same thing, and that unlocked the whole treasure of antiquity. I think one of them is cuneiform, I think.
But that's one that they already knew.
Yeah. You're right. I was wrong. I was thinking the wrong thing.
This person initially investigated the name and named the Cambrian rocks. First of all, what are the Cambrian rocks?
Well, Cambrian is a geological strata, geological age, very ancient. I don't know how many.
Also means whales.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, well, I think this strata was discovered in Wales. Yeah. That's how it got the name.
And if true, then I suppose those are the celebrated rocks of the tale of Griselda. I mean, of Constance, which gave her the hang-up over her husband's business trips.
Well, the man who found it necessary to look into them and name them was Adam Sedgwick. Old Adam.
He had nothing else to do. He said, well, I think I'll go out and name some rocks.
He comes as a great surprise to me. I never heard his name before.
Oh, not complete surprise. Just like any other name in the phone book you might stumble across, but I never heard of him.
All right.
I'm sorry, but...
Who is the man who proved that the malaria germ is carried by the Anopheles mosquito?
Walter Reed?
No.
No.
I think he found out how to get rid of them.
Carlos Finlay?
Giovanni Grassi.
Well, I'm glad he did.
Adrenaline was first isolated by whom?
George Drenlin.
A man by the name of Giacchichi Taccamini.
I'm not a bit ashamed not to know these things.
No, I'm not ashamed either. I have no shame, no sense of shame left whatsoever.
The names of the two men who first invented the balloon and made the initial ascent.
That's what you should ask him, that.
Montgolfier or whatever
they
were.
That's right. They were brothers in...
They were brothers in Paris.
Stefan and Joseph. They did not exactly invent the balloon.
No, I'm sure they didn't invent the balloon. They got a lot of newspaper coverage in the 18th century by going up.
They were the ones that went up with... I forget whether they used hot air or gas.
Well, the principle of lighter-than-air craft was known long before those brothers.
They were the first two who went up and made the first ascent. As I say, I forget whether they used gas or hot air, but there was another gentleman who was using the other media and did it very closely.
The great discovery was how to support heavier than air, don't you think?
Yeah,
It's what's made the whole industry. And
have sometimes been brought to question whether the Wright brothers really knew that they were...
What they were getting into?
That they were supporting heavier than air. If you look at that plane very carefully, as I've done many times, and examine, too, the slope that they went down, it doesn't really look as if they thought they were going to support something that was heavier than air.
Well, of course, anybody that ever threw a baseball demonstrates the supporting a heavier than air object.
Yeah, but again, do you know you're doing that? I'm not going to quarrel with the aeronautical historians, except that they ran this thing down a track.
Yeah.
And it was designed in such a way that it was clear they were hoping most of the air would pass through
The balloon, by the way, when they started using hot air, they thought at first that the material that you burned had some effect. They didn't realize it was the heat that did it. They thought the material you burned was what made the balloon go up better. So they started burning things like chicken feathers and raw meat and made it smell bad.
I still think the airplane's more important. They would not want to go to New York in a balloon.
Can't hijack one very easily.
Although
The
first transatlantic flights were in lighter than air.
Oh, yeah. Dirigibles, Zeppelins, called this week.
Hindenburg, for instance.
It's the telephone that's really messed in the high electric wires that have messed up balloon flight. You can't go around the country anymore. They used to rent balloons. There was a rented drive-it-yourself balloon service in England before the turn of the century.
Good night.
That's right. You're a balloon expert, aren't you?
I don't really imagine, however, that they would... credit card companies would very easily allow you to charge your balloon flight for they'd never see you again.
They had a problem. One of the problems with the balloon is it keeps going up and down. You let the gas out, and it goes down, but then as it gets closer to the airway, it goes to the earth, it goes back up a little bit. So what they did was drag a rope, and as it went down, they would be dragging more rope, with lifting less. As it went up, they would be carrying more rope, and there'd be less of it on the ground.
So you mean in addition to problems with electric wires, you couldn't have anything on the street either?
I was thinking of the problems that this caused at that time. Is out working in the field, and this great big rope all of a sudden cuts through his field, knocks over his horses and everything else.
You mean the rope wasn't there all the time? How did they arrange that?
No, the rope was fastened in the balloon, and 100 feet of it fell down, and then there might be 50 feet of it on the ground. And as the balloon went up, 25 of those feet would suddenly be supported by the balloon, and that would help to stabilize it. It would bring it back down again. The first rule of balloon flight, if you ever get invited, is don't step out of the balloon when it hits the ground.
Because it might go right back up again?
It will go right back up again unless it's fastened. In fact, the first balloon, the man that flied in the balloon the first time discovered that. That was the first rule of balloon flight.
My father used to tell a story, and I can't remember anything but the tagline. And the tagline was, the wheel came off the wagon and the balloon went up, and he wouldn't marry her because she had a wooden leg.
All right, now, if anybody...
hilarious joke.
We'd like the listeners to write the joke that goes before that. Now, would you repeat the answer?
The wheel came off the wagon, and the balloon went up, and he wouldn't marry her because she had a wooden leg.
All right, you may send in your jokes that go with that tagline. And the first 10 jokes will do something wonderful for. I don't know what... We'll give you a balloon, I suppose.
Or a wooden leg.
What's the name of the island behind which the Greeks hid until the gates of Troy were opened from within?
Oh, dear.
In reconstructing the story, if I had been asked to do so, I think I would have just omitted that detail.
I have just finished, as I told you last week, Day Lewis's translation of the Aeneid, in which that island is prominently mentioned. But I cannot answer.
Tenedos, T-E-N-E-D-O-S.
Oh, Tenedos,
The four symbols of the Roman god Mars are what?
I would say thunderbolts.
No, I don't think so. That's Zeus.
Oh?
Yeah. Well, they're war symbols.
They're weapons, aren't they? Aren't they all weapons?
Shield, maybe?
Shield is one of them.
Machine gun.
Probably a spear or a mace. Or
a shield, a sword, a vulture, and for some reason or other, a dog. The dogs of war.
The dogs of war. Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war.
This person died of grief when he was unable to tell how many figs were in the branches of a certain fig tree, and another person mentioned the correct number.
Well, he was one of the great idiots of history.
Yes, if that sort of thing would bust him.
Calchas, C-A-L-C-H-A-S.
Oh, you mean the prophet?
Yeah. I don't know why he did it, but there we were.
I don't believe that.
No, I don't believe it. No one could be that silly.
Well, anyway, Mr. Budd, we didn't do too well with your questions, which were very difficult, so we'll send you a subscription to The Atlantic, America's leading magazine of information, entertainment, news, and ideas. And now we'll ask Mr. Rushlow to explain how other people can send questions to this program.
The questions used on this program, unless they happen to be asked by the professors themselves, are submitted by our listeners. If your question stumps the professors within the boundaries set when we put the questions to them, you'll receive a subscription to a national magazine. Harper's, one of America's oldest and most respected magazines. Atlantic, America's leading magazine of information, entertainment, news, and ideas. And America, the National Weekly Review. Send your questions to Ask the Professor, radio station WJR, the Fisher Building, Detroit. Radio station WJR, Fisher Building, Detroit. Or to the station to which you are now listening. Please don't forget to include your name and address. And those correct answers. Now, back to the University of Detroit professors.
Well, you catch me unprepared, Michael. This is the business of opening the mail, which has not been opened, and reading at random. It's sort of risky, like reading at random from the Old Testament. Miss Joan Pearson from London, Ontario, says, if you were living in the year 1969...
Which we are...
And yet you regarded the year as 4,607. What would be your nationality?
You would be a Mohammedan. I think you'd be a Turk.
4,607.
Isn't that the Mohammedan calendar?
Well, I think we can rule out that it's Hebrew.
No, because, that's 5728.
Well, you've just answered the next one. That's the Hebrew calendar, 5730 this year.
5730.
Am I wrong about the Mohammedan?
You're wrong about that Mohammedan, yes. There are three of these. No, you have 5730. Someplace this is the year 6,210.
Chinese.
And someplace it's 4,607.
Well, Chinese and Hebrew, I don't know who that leaves us, if not Mohammed.
Well,
Buddhist, maybe.
4,607 is Chinese.
Oh, it is?
No.
I thought things have been around longer than that.
So who's 6,210?
Well, you know, the odometer turned over.
Oh, I see. Never by a year.
See, the Mohammedan is gauged by the return to Mecca, isn't it?
There's
it wouldn't be the 4,000.
No,
it wouldn't be that.
No, it wouldn't.
Back.
No, that's true. That's true.
That's the Egyptian year.
Egyptian, eh?
Does Nasser use that?
Constantly.
It's conceivable. That may be the trouble, you see, is that... Between as they quarrel over the Gaza Strip, one of them's 1,000 years off.
Yeah.
Remember Edwin used to say, "I'm going to egg wipes."
Yeah.
Well, in any case, we made one out of three on that, and we award to Miss Pearson a renewal to her subscription to Harper's. Harper's, one of America's oldest and most respected magazines. Well, let's see what we have now. We have something from Hazel Park, Michigan, Jackson, Michigan, and Bay City. Let's try Jackson, see what we can find. Thomas Gavin, Christie Street in Jackson. They say it's always...
Nobody can deny, with the use of those sound effects, the authentic, unrehearsed character of this thing.
Nobody could deny that in any case, I think.
We'd like the professors to identify the famous villains of these works. Let's see, should I give you the villain or give you the work?
Give it the work, I think, and identify the villain.
The Maltese Falcon. Who is the villain?
Sidney Greenstreet
played it.
Well, I'll have to accept that, but on the rest of them, I'll have to point out that we're concerned with the literary work and we're concerned with the name of the character.
Mr. What was his name? I haven't read The Maltese Falcon, of course, in years, because it's not the sort of thing you read over and over again.
Caspar Gutman.
Mr. Gutman, right.
That's right. Havelock the Dane.
Have a what?
Havelock the Dane.
Well, that's ultimately Hamlet. Havelock the Dane is the story from...
Havelock the Dane?
Yeah, Havelock
the Dane. I thought that was his last name.
It's the story from
Mac
Hamlet Dane. Came, and I don't know. And it's pretty... pretty similar, but I...
Well, is Claudius in it? Then he's the villain.
No, the name
no he does not have... Havelock the Dane has other characteristics, which are romance in style. I mean, his light comes out of his mouth when he sleeps, and that's how he's recognized as Havelock. It's as good as you can expect.
Taps it out in Morse code or something?
No, but you see, he was an early example of sinus trouble. But he slept with an open mouth, and his lady friend could only recognize him. She'd get him open his mouth while he was asleep. Now there's a strange light came out of his mouth. But I don't really know who the villain would be unless it was some guy who pulled the fuse.
Goddard. Mr. Goddard is given as the villain.
Goddard?
Who is Goddard? G-O-D-A-R-D.
The middle Goddard.
Havelock the Dane, a middle English verse romance of uncertain authorship.
True, but it's one of the precursors of Hamlet the Dane.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Goddard's the bad guy. Whoever
it could
he
be.
Is,
I don't
check
remember.
It out and look out next time. Throw it out on the table and see whether it salutes the flag. Out of the Silent Planet and Perlandra by C.S. Lewis. Who is the villain?
Oh, for heaven's sake.
The devil.
Well, in Perlander, it could be, because that's that recapitulation of Adam and Eve.
By C.S. Lewis?
Yeah.
Yeah, but he has a professor.
Out of the Silent Planet is
not C.D. Lewis.
No,
C.S. Lewis, C.S. Lewis, Clive Staples Lewis. But Out of the Silent Planet is Mars. Isn't that trip to Mars? Isn't Mars the Silent Planet? Perlander is on Venus.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't remember.
Professor Weston.
Yeah,
Professor
yes, I do remember that. I mean, didn't recall it, but that's quite right.
Bend Sinister by Vladimir Nabokov.
No, you're getting too obscure.
I don't know that book.
Paduk. Song of Roland.
Ganelon.
Yeah, Ganelon. That'd be the villain. Although, he's a villain. He betrays him.
And The Hound of the Baskervilles. Who is the villain?
Hound of the Baskervilles' villain is Mr. He's the boy that has the hound.
Stapleton, wasn't that his name?
But he was really a Baskerville.
Stapleton's a Merripit house, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
Baskerville Kennels, Clive Stapleton trainer, dogs trained and boarded. That was the ad. So we award a subscription on that one, too. We answered 2 out of 6.
Very well earned, that subscription.
A subscription to America, the National
Except
Weekly
Except for the
Review.
Nabokov one. I think all of them might have been known.
Yeah.
I remember.
Right. Some one of us could have known all of them.
Now, where's the next one? Let's say take the one from Bay City. See what they find in
it. Things are getting really tough.
I predict that Bay City will be very simple.
Do you think it's a plot?
I guess. It seems to be surrounding us, Bay City, Jack.
International communist.
When you get one from Toledo, we're surrounded.
It's a ring. The I-75 crowd.
This one's from Paul B. Grine, a sixth grade teacher at the Adam Kolb Inter School. What is that? Intermediate School, Bay City, Michigan. I enjoy listening to your informal sessions with the professor's Sunday evenings. Recently, I assigned my advanced literature class the task of doing some research on little-used words in America. They did surprisingly well in their diggings and wonder if the professors know the meaning of the following. Hootenanny, other than a gathering of folk singers.
Well,
I have never exactly understood the etymology of hootenanny.
Well, it's associated some way with a goat, but I suppose that's because of the nanny.
I don't think so, Fred.
It's a transfer, and I should know this because I read it somewhere quite recently. It had to do with something like a picnic, and the music which was accompanying it. Turned into the hootenanny. But
it has a very broad set of meanings, incidentally, some of which I will not mention.
It's spelled that way, incidentally.
Yeah. The two answers, the two meanings he gives, he takes from Webster's. And the first is a generic term, and the second is a specific device, a mechanical device. Does that help any?
Nope.
No, but I'd say that the first one is probably something like a picnic or a...
I associate it with clothes somewhat.
A device or piece of mechanical equipment used especially when the standard name is unknown. For example, like the hootenanny that goes on top of the carburetor.
Oh, like a thingamajig.
Thingamajig.
Mr. Stuvendegger, I mean, I can't.
Gee, I haven't. That's right, but I haven't heard. That's way out of date for Webster's.
I never heard it used.
I can remember that, but it's 30 years ago, or 25 years ago that I remember the hootenanny up over there.
Oh, I never did.
It's also a device for holding a crosscut saw from underside.
Well, I imagine that came about in the same way. You know, what's that hootenanny you got holding your saw there?
It's like a dingbat.
So what's the generic meaning?
Well, the generic would be the any piece of equipment.
Oh.
Gimmick.
No, I'm sorry. Webster's Third or something.
Serendipity is the other word.
Well, that's the art of discovering
What you didn't expect to find when you've traveled. You find wonderful...
Name of a magazine.
Experiences, and you didn't expect to have.
I haven't seen that in
a long
time.
And it's from the name of a imaginary country called Serendip.
Let's publicize Serendipity a little bit.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I believe that it is in Serendipity that three articles on the Project 100 is appearing, curiously.
Hmm. Well, it was put out by one of the bookmen.
Oh, well, you're thinking Serendipity is a magazine now, at least, which is published by the Metropolitan Detroit English Conference.
Oh, well, then they stole the name from this guy.
Wasn't Serendip
believed
to be on the island of Ceylon? Why do I connect that?
I don't know.
Probably from a limerick, Serendipity on Ceylon or something.
Who wrote the fairy tale?
What
you talk about the Serendip, the country of Serendip. You know who did it? Horace Walpole. The word was coined by Horace Walpole from the title of a fairy tale, The Three Princesses of Serendip. Yeah. These princesses, according to Walpole, always making discoveries and sagacity of things they were not in quest of. The Oxford English Dictionary definition is which I think you have fulfilled, is the faculty of making happy the unexpected discoveries by accident. Well, I think you did 50-50 on that one, and we'll let you stand ahead of Mr. Grine.
Well, I think we did 50. I think we did Serendipity perfectly.
In particular, Mr. McLaughlin, going back to the country that was involved.
I think our discussion was extremely...
Maybe we ought to set up or arrange for half-year subscriptions for these ties.
Try again, Mr. Grine. That's a good question. We always like to know whether we can do better than the clients. Here's a short one from Mrs. Gerald Thompson of Halifax, PA.
I always thought it was in Nova Scotia.
She wants to know a beauty shop term, guiche, G-U-I-C-H-E, guiche, or guiche, G-U-I-C-H-E.
I've been to a beauty shop lately.
You went in and said, I'd like my hair guiched. What would they do?
I'd be afraid.
I know, I would be afraid to try.
I'd look for the weapon they chose.
I don't think that is
I'll
addressable to our sex. Exactly.
No, we need a broad in here.
You want to answer it in broad terms. When the hair is brushed forward to form a curve or swirl on one's face near the cheek, you have been guicheed.
Like Veronica Lake? Is that what they mean?
So, yeah. So we'll award another subscription. Goodness, giving things away on this program. To America, the National Weekly Review.
As you know, Fred, every town of some mile fame that you may have heard of is also located in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, there are an awful lot of towns in Pennsylvania.
Such notable facts as that Indiana State and California State colleges are both in Pennsylvania.
Mr. Blackwell of Hazel Park, Michigan, gives us some names and middle initials, and he wants the middle names. For example, John D. Rockefeller.
Dingbat.
I swear it's David, isn't it?
That's very close. Davison, John Davison.
Well, there goes the ear again. You know, just something remembered vaguely.
Yeah.
James K. Polk.
Knox.
Knox. Yeah, I knew that.
James A. Garfield.
Abrams.
Rutherford B. Hayes.
Richard.
Chester A. Arthur.
Allen.
I thought it was Arthur. No.
Chester Allen Arthur.
Allen Arthur, yes.
Phineas T. Barnum.
P.T. Barnum. Phineas T.
I never heard.
Yes,
the
I have
before.
Heard. Phineas T. Well, it was something unlikely, like Taliaferro, wasn't it?
It's the same middle initial, same middle name that I have. Only Russell probably doesn't
Taylor.
Know that.
Taylor?
That's right. Oh, you know it, too, huh? I didn't know I ever signed my name. My father's middle name was Tillionson. It's the only time I've ever heard the name used. If there's anyone named Tillionson in the radio audience, would you tell me, please? I'd like to know where that came from. He claimed his mother made it up because she thought it sounded nice. Booker T. Washington.
That was Taliaferro.
Yeah.
That's right. What is
Which
Taliaferro?
Which is pronounced Tolliver, isn't it?
Tolliver is the way it's pronounced, yeah. Is.
Where does it come from? What is it, sir?
Well, I suppose it was an Italian word originally.
I haven't any idea.
Sounds like an Italian name, don't you think?
Do you know why Cecil B. DeMille didn't use his middle name?
No.
Because it didn't mean anything.
Do you know what it is?
No.
Well, instead of being, this is Cecil B. DeMille in Hollywood, he would have said, this is Cecil Blount DeMille in Hollywood. You never would have gotten the last name. The middle name would drown it up. William S. Gilbert.
Schwenk. Schwenk.
Schwenk.
S-C-H-W-E-N-C-K.
And Arthur S. Sullivan.
Seymour.
Seymour. Schwenk. Well, you missed 1, 2, 3 out of those 10, and I think that is a satisfactory performance on...
Terrible, I would advise the audience at large. It's a terrible thing to do, is to send in...
middle
requests,
names.
Middle names with Fred Hayes here, especially when there are 8 of them are presidents.
Everyone
I've already forgotten Rutherford B. Hayes.
All right, Russell, what is it? What is it? We just heard
no,
it.
You knew that.
No, I didn't.
Huh?
Burchard or?
Burchard.
Burchard, yes.
All right, let's try once again. Chester A. Arthur, who remembers that?
Alan.
Rutherford B. Hayes.
Burchard.
James A. Garfield.
Adams.
Abram. James K. Polk.
You know,
Knox.
Phineas T. Barnum.
Taylor.
John D. Rockefeller.
Davison.
Booker T. Washington.
Taliaferro.
Cecil B. DeMille.
Brunt.
I suppose that one.
That's very interesting, Russell. You did. You picked them up. And
I'll point out.
With no reason whatsoever to remember them.
I would remind you, if I could, that several months ago, I organized a society for the study of middle names. If you remember, it received indecent lack of exposure.
Here's a question.
But if you recall, it had to do with the probabilities of presidential election.
Oh, that's right.
What was the full name of Charles Dickens?
Next week, we will find out. What was the full name of Charles Dickens?
Charles John Huffam Dickens.
Oh, you blew it. That's the class bell and the end of another session of Ask the Professor. Our panel today, Russell McLaughlin, Fred Hayes, and John Mahoney. Now this message from the University of Detroit.
This question for James T. Mansfield, Director of Admissions at the University of Detroit. What are present policies on testing and test requirements in the face of charges of test racial discrimination?
Well, it's been a very obvious point that such national-type tests that are used primarily to consider students for admission into college have definitely not been geared toward the inner-city disadvantaged student, and so entire new studies are being developed in the face of this. In the meantime, about all that admissions officers at colleges throughout the country can do is take into consideration that because of deficiencies in inner-city education, the fact that had this student had an opportunity in a suburban situation, probably would have done better on the test, they generally scale the tests back down a certain percent and take it into account.
Thank you, Mr. Mansfield. For further information, write University of Detroit Radio, Detroit 48221. That's U of D Radio, Detroit 48221.
The prizes awarded on this program are provided by the magazine publishers. Ask the Professor was transcribed through the facilities of the E.J. Smith Broadcasting Center on the University of Detroit campus. Mike Rushlow is the announcer, the technical director is Phil Feichert, and this is the man with all of the questions and most of the answers, Bill Raby.